Serve It Cold, episode 24. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Butch, it's Pete. This is what they call a courtesy call. One of the kids, a reporter of the Stratus, just happened to take a call from a friend on speaker while he was sitting in my cruiser, and, well, I accidentally left my recorder on. And knowing your history out of Burnt Bridge and all, well, I thought you might be interested. So, let me know if you think it has any probative value.
Dude!
Rabbit, where the hell are you?
Pikmin store on the highway. My cell is worthless. Like, zero bars, dude.
Man, I'm glad to hear you, Rabbit. So, you all right?
Sure, I'm as right as I can be, standing on the side of the road wearing a damn dress covered with ketchup. I'm just peachy, dude.
Good. I was worried that you got popped, too.
Popped? You mean like bang bang you're dead popped? What the hell happened down there, dude? Whole swamp lit up like a Kmart special at Christmas time. I booked.
Cops and robbers, man. Cops and robbers. We found a real dead body under the bridge, and you won't believe who the hell it is.
Under the bridge? What the hell are you doing parking under the bridge before I did my headless woman thing?
Now, don't get your frilly panties in a wad, Rabbit. I just needed to set the scene. I mean, Marianne had never even heard of the headless woman, and Julie heard some crazy story about a dead girl in a prom dress riding the hood of your car. Where's the tradition, man? These young ones are clueless. I had to get them ready for you. So, go ahead and guess who the damn body is, Rabbit.
You real? You really found the body under the bridge? A dead body?
Just guess.
Dude, side of the road, dress, ketchup. Just tell me what you got to say and come pick me up.
It was Reganet, that triple R dude with that cranked up pot at the club the other night. My cousin Terry is working the case for the Lamar County Sheriffs. Says the word is that Reganet ran over that crazy Grantham doctor in Lamar Park. Twice.
I thought somebody shot that dude.
No, not that Grantham, his brother. The one that strips with that kick-ass blonde over on Lake Shady Everett. Ah, damn. There goes another tradition. Fishing is never going to be the same.
So somebody killed Reganet in both Granthams now? Tell Terry he needs to go CSI on Goat Johnson. You do know he's Darlene's brother, right? Everyone knows that Reganet kidnapped Darlene to sell her to white slavers. They made her bleach her hair. I saw her with Johnny C, and she was smoking hot.
Rabbit, you're reading too many detective novels. Besides, bleach hair or not, Darlene is as black as iron.
Hell, you know what I'm saying.
You know Goat's not gonna get his hands dirty. Pete says that he's heard that Goat's hired Johnny C to take care of things. And that sunny guy that Darlene was with the other night, she told Julie that he's Goat's bodyguard.
Dude, just come get me before some freak shows up and wants to rub his french fry all over my ketchup.
Yeah, about that. I let Cooter take the girls home in my car. Pete said he would give me...
Cooter? You took Cooter Brown to my girlfriend parking under Burnt Bridge?
Now, Rabbit, it's not like you gave her a ring or...
And you let that sneaky son of a bitch take her home?
I couldn't turn this down. I'm learning more criminal justice out here tonight than I'd get in a month of ass time in front of Dr. Boredom. Oh, one thing, Rabbit. Look around the parking lot there and see if you can find something to wipe the ketchup off yourself. See, Pete's driving this brand new squad car...
I slept hard and deep, and waking was like struggling up from the bottom of a dark, salty well. At the surface, I lay gasping for a while, letting the sounds and smells of the present world seep back into me, slowly convincing myself I wasn't still floating on Lake Bourne. The old sleeping porch was now suffused with half-light. From the kitchen came the smells of bacon cooking, coffee brewing. I could hear people talking, and the soft clatter of spoon against coffee cup. I shook my head, still disoriented. How could I have slept through the whole night? How did the dogs and Vera let me sleep through the whole night? I realized that I was still dressed. Was I sick? Well, sicker than usual. It took me a couple of minutes of padding down the room before I found where I'd tossed my glasses down. Then I stumbled out into the kitchen, where I tried to convince myself that I was still dreaming. There was Lily Banks Grantham, leaning against the sink, drinking from my favorite Carol Beale coffee cup. Vera was sitting in front of her, in one of our metal folding chairs, her arms held at an awkward angle behind her. It took me a couple of more steps to realize that she had been handcuffed, with her arms held behind the back of the chair. As usual, there were dogs lying all over the floor like basking seals waiting for someone to feed them. A voice from my left called out,
"Well, hello, Sleeping Beauty. It was so nice of you to join us."
I pivoted to see Cindy Altman standing with my favorite Shearwater pottery cup in one hand and a beautifully crafted handgun in the other. I looked back toward the pod of lounging, overfed dogs and yelled, "What in the hell are you so-called watchdogs doing with your lives?" A couple of disinterested heads turned my way, then dropped to the floor again before Cindy said,
"They love me too, Johnny Speed."
It was one of those sickening aha moments. They had been listening. They either had passive bugs that Lurker couldn't find, or they had bugged the place last night while Lurker was going through the files he had sucked off their wireless network. Did you really think it was necessary to eavesdrop?
Actually, no. But, you know, I had bought the damn thing, and I thought we should use it rather than just toss it away. And anyway, I hear that there is a theory that while Lily is the exhibitionist, I'm the voyeur. Or at least, I try to squeeze some voyeuring in whenever I'm not out puppet mastering and masterminding.
With great effort, I took my eyes off the gun and turned away. Vera, are you all right?
I'm fine, Johnny. She threatened to shoot the dogs.
It's all right.
The hell it is. It is not all right. Didn't you learn in detecting school to watch a drawn gun? How are you going to wrestle it from my hand if you don't keep your eyes on it?
Ah, but I'm not a dog. I haven't been officially threatened.
Consider yourself threatened. And, Mr. Speed, do take the threat seriously. My little sister taught that bastard Latimer Grantham to shoot, and I taught my sister.
Okay. Your qualification as handgun expert has been duly noted. More to the point, you're holding my 1990 Shearwater blue cup. I don't think I'll be rushing you anytime soon. She took a careful sip, eyes not leaving mine.
Yes, it is a fine cup, and the coffee in it is superb. I've been hearing about your coffee all week, and I admit it exceeds expectations. What kind is it?
Vera answered from behind me.
I made Sumatra Iskandar for you, Johnny.
I said to Cindy, that makes it official. You're drinking my favorite coffee from my favorite cup while holding a gun on me. I think you are definitely trying to piss me off, but I won't take it personally. In fact, I'll bring a thermos of Iskandar down to you at the jail.
I'll keep you to that if the need arises. Just don't forget to include a file in the thermos. Now, please sit in the other folding chair, and we can get down to business. Don't worry too much. We're not here to hurt you. In fact, we'd like to exchange some information with you.
I sat, noting that the chairs had been placed with care. Cindy could cover both of us at once, but we were separated by a good 8 feet, and we couldn't see each other. I started thinking about how to lure Lily into that gap, shielding Vera.
I'm sorry that we couldn't find another pair of handcuffs. I would really prefer to not have to keep holding up this gun.
I've got another pair in my van. Just let me run out and get them.
So, you are funny. I'd heard that about you, Johnny. Do you mind if I call you that?
I started to say, I've been waiting for you to do that for 15 years. But I decided that that would only pitch Vera into a blind rage and get everyone killed. I contented myself with, please do. I can feel the Stockholm Syndrome taking effect already. Do you prefer Cindy or Cynthia?
Oh, Cindy, by all means. Cynthia died with my illusions. The Granthams helped that process along when they killed my little sister. Okay, Johnny, Vera, let me tell you why I've called you here for this meeting. Lily and I are going away. No, no, don't shed tears. We plan to live happily ever after. We just don't want to get mixed up with all the turmoil that's going to surround the things that have happened in the last week. But we do want our side of the story told. I've also heard that you like stories, Johnny, and this is a good one. The box beside that fancy new computer of yours contains the files from 5 years of investigations that will prove to anyone with a working brain that Latimer Grantham stole pictures from the house shared by Lily, Marie, and myself in 1981. The Grantham boys were part of the group after you and Meg moved out, Vera. They were the dirty old men in the scene, and they played their parts to the hilt. 10 years later, Latimer used these pictures to blackmail Marie into marrying him. There had to be more to it, but I know the pictures were part of it. Marie hardly talked to me at all in those days, but whenever she did, she would end up crying about ever taking those pictures. The files will also show that 5 years ago, Latimer Grantham had my sister killed and used the insurance money to pay off gambling debts that he had accrued in the illegal Bouray houses on the coast. His darling brother, Landis, arranged for the murder that was carried out by none other than Rayford Raphael Ragnett. By this time, Lily was married to Landis. Admittedly, a marriage of convenience, right, Lily?
Right on cue, the consummate actress moved into my field of view.
Yes, it was that old cliché, I'm married for love. The love of money. The Granthams had been chasing after me since I was 16 years old, and my day job was cutting into my acting work. So I decided to let them catch me and pay the bills for a while. Marie was already married to Latimer, so that left Landis. But the sex was mostly with Marie and Latimer right from the start. Landis was really more into watching than doing. We made a sick, twisted little foursome, but we were happy. At least I thought so at the time.
Cindy took over the story again.
You've got to give Latimer credit for learning. As far as our investigators could determine, he never gambled again. But he picked up a new hobby, blackmail. He used those pictures he'd stolen from us and managed to squeeze enough money out of little old Catherine, Mississippi, to buy Lily from Landis for, how much was it, dear?
$250,000.
The blonde beauty said proudly, arching her back to show off her perfect breasts.
It was all really some weird head game. Almost all of their money was pooled in a family corporation account, but they always knew to the penny how much of the fund belonged to which brother. Landis always claimed the lion's share of the fund. He'd been making sweetheart deals with oil companies for years, and we're talking big money. The worst thing about them killing Marie is that it wasn't because they really needed the cash. The damn fund had over $6 million in it at the low point. Landis was just pissed off that Latimer wasn't pulling his weight financially and refused to let him use the fund money to bail himself out.
I ventured into the conversation. I take it that, since all the money was tied up in the corporation in case of death, the surviving brother would inherit the entire fund, cutting out the widow.
Very good, Johnny. We've told you all of this to show you that, for the brothers Grantham, women were trifles to be traded, sold, or even killed at whim. They were also so arrogant that they somehow thought of Lily as just a beautiful exhibitionist airhead and not an intellectual equal. And, of course, they never thought that a departmental secretary at a major university could possibly know more about computers than they did. How could she? She had only been making $16,000 a year. By the way, in the box, you'll also find a stack of CDs with the financial files that support the investigation reports. Anyway, Lily got curious, poked around, and started putting a few things together. She called me. I've been lucky these past few years. My drawings and sketches have been selling for good prices. I was able to finance several investigations. Some were profitable, some not. We kept them compartmentalized because we didn't know who to trust. 2 years ago, I moved back to Catherine and started work on the show that you attended this week, Johnny. We wanted to use this show to confront the brothers and to take away the power of blackmail. Who would pay or continue to pay blackmail after my drawings had been made public? And, just between us, we had planned to blackmail the blackmailers. Yes, I wanted revenge for Marie's death, but killing them was not what we had in mind. We wanted a large cut of that family fund, and we thought we could pressure them into giving Lily a very equitable divorce settlement.
I heard Vera speak from behind me.
Somehow, two pops to the back of the head doesn't seem like your normal divorce settlement.
No, it doesn't. And we didn't have anything to do with any of the deaths this week. I've already told you that killing was too good for the Granthams. We planned to bleed them dry, but something went wrong, very wrong. We hired you, Johnny, to be an independent observer of everything leading up to the show. We already knew that something was going wrong when Ray Raggenit showed up and started pressuring Latimer to bankroll his fledgling drug empire. Lily and I knew who and what Raggenit was by this time. I'm sure that he threatened Latimer. Maybe Latimer tried to hire someone to push back. I don't know. After Landis was killed, Latimer just went off the deep end. He wouldn't eat, couldn't sleep. He just smoked dope and drank whiskey. He was sure that Raggenit had killed Landis, and he hatched a new plan every hour about how to kill Ray. Of course, he couldn't tell us why he thought Raggenit was the killer. He just knew. He wanted to use Lily as bait, but I put my foot down there. When he set up that last buy, he was supposed to leave cash for the pot under the table. He figured that he would stiff Raggenit and then lure him to somewhere more remote to collect the money so he could kill him. I guess Ray was just too smart for the esteemed Dr. Grantham.
Somewhere more remote like Burnt Bridge, perhaps? So, who did kill Raggenit?
We don't know. We think it has something to do with the people Landis hired to kill Marie in the first place. But it could just as easily be whoever Ray stole his drugs from. The man had plenty of enemies. We heard you talking with the cop about there being a passenger in Ray's car. Maybe it was the passenger that killed Ray.
Well, this all sounds plausible, ladies, but if you're innocent, why run? Why don't you stay and ride it out? I'm sure you know that I can provide your alibis for at least two of the three murders. No harm, no foul. Put down the gun, I'll give Butch a call. You two can end up with the jackpot. Family fund, the two houses, the cars, and all the land. Why start all over? I could see that Lily was considering my argument, but Cindy was having none of it.
No, I never played bourrée, and I don't plan to start gambling now. I've made enough money to take care of us both, one tiny pencil line at a time. We don't need Grantham money. taking it after they're dead wouldn't be nearly as satisfying as blackmailing them and watching them squirm. And rotting in jail for their deaths doesn't sound like fun at all. And we're scared, Johnny. Whoever paid for Landis to be killed is still out there. Whoever killed Ray is still out there. And they may not even be the same person. No, thanks. I think it's time to move on.
Cindy, you know that if you go underground, you won't be able to show and sell your work. Do you think you have enough salted away to last two lifetimes of being on the run? And can you really stop drawing in your own style?
You certainly don't know the art world. I've already set up a pipeline to get my work out and to the collectors, and I expect my prices will at least triple if they charge us for murder. True, I wouldn't be able to attend my own art shows and listen to boring people make incredibly stupid statements about my drawings. You know, I think I could survive without it.
Cindy grew silent. She seemed to be running over in her mind the list of things she had wanted to tell me, that eyes rolled up to the left thing. I thought about rushing her, but I was feeling pretty good about our chances of getting out of this predicament without any bullet holes in us. Meanwhile, Lily walked out of my view toward Vera. I tried to listen for footsteps to locate her, but all I could hear was the drive hum from our four running computers.
You stick that tongue in my mouth, I'll bite it off, bitch.
Cindy popped out of her reverie.
Lily Banks, can't you keep it in your pants for just a few minutes?
I said to Cindy, shoot me if you want to, but I'm watching this, and turned in my seat to find Lily actually sitting in Vera's lap. At least she had put down my coffee cup. Cindy's reproach just egged Lily on. She pulled her silk blouse open and cupped both breasts.
How about a nipple? Would you bite my nipple, Vera? It's been a long time, honey.
Just stick it in and see, Lily.
Lily actually started to lean forward, and Cindy went ballistic.
Lily, stop! We don't have time to waste getting your nipple reattached. Damn it, Lily, I told you to lay off that crap until we get clear.
Lily leaned back, but kept her blouse open.
It was just a little bit, Cindy Lou. I just couldn't flush it all, could I? I'll be good. I'll just pet her a while. Are you about done with this already?
Cindy rolled her eyes and backed up to the sink, where Lily had been standing when I came into the room. From there, she once again could cover both of us, although her marksmanship would be truly remarkable if she could shoot Vera without hitting Lily. Actually, she looked as if she wouldn't mind if she shot Lily right then.
Since it seems I'm going to have to drag little Miss ADD off your wife before there's bloodshed, I think we'd better wrap things up. Would like another cup of this coffee, though.
Help yourself. Just, please use a go cup. They're right over the coffee pot.
By the way, I would like you to send your report and the pictures you've taken to my lawyers in Grand Cayman. They will send what they deem appropriate to the authorities. Send them a bill, too. They will send you your payment and a nice bonus. The address is in the box. Now, did I get everything clear? Any questions?
Only about 1,000 or so. I started with, why me? Why did you pick me to do this? She nodded toward Vera.
Well, we do have a connection to the family. To tell the truth, though, that connection is why we didn't hire you for any of the earlier investigations. But you were very highly recommended by one of our earlier investigators.
She answered my questioning look with a bombshell.
John Turner.
When did you talk to Big John? She was already shaking her head.
No, he didn't speak from the grave. He recommended you when he finished his work with us, almost 2 years ago, I guess. It's in the files.
I felt my shoulders slump in reaction to her answer. I asked, what about the other private eye that I was warned about? Who was he?
We don't know. When Raganet showed up, I kept feeling that someone was following us around. Things seemed to be moved from where we left them. You know, It just felt like someone was snooping. Somebody working with Ray? Maybe. It could have just been one of Lily's fans waiting for her to drop her drawers again, but I didn't think so. We just wanted to warn you that there might be someone else investigating out there.
Lily's apartment at Blue Pines?
Oh, it's her apartment, all right. She's kept it right through the marriage. A little getaway from the Granthams. I've been living there for the last 6 months. I had been staying out at my parents' old farm in Covington County, but I wanted to be closer at hand when the show started coming together.
I started to say something about Raginette being at the farm, but I decided not to waste my breath. She would have an answer. She had all the answers. Instead, I said, "One more question. Who made the call to me pretending to be Landis? Who actually hired me?"
"I think I'll let Lily answer that. Lily?"
Lily, still sitting in my wife's lap, now had a hand inside Vera's blouse while still cupping one of her own breasts. I couldn't help but think that Lily wouldn't be happy with the comparison. She turned toward me, cleared her throat, and said,
"This is so awkward. Lillian is threatening to make accusations that might very well endanger my career, when in fact it is she who has not been faithful to the marriage."
It was the voice. I couldn't believe that such a sonorous, male sound could come from that throat. The only reply I could give was a heartfelt, "Shit!" And then, as we say down here, all hell broke loose. You see, although both Vera and I have been trying to clean up our language for at least a decade, the word shit has a very special meaning in our house. In dog speak, it can be roughly translated as, "Johnny's cooking and he's just dropped some food again. First dog on the scene cleans up." So when I uttered that magic word, the dog logs scattered around the floor came to life and started their all-out race to get under my feet. At least the Labrador dog logs jumped up. The fox terrier was still dreaming of Rodentia, no doubt. But when Bryn, our big 2-year-old beauty, rushed by, Wilna's tiny reptilian brain reacted to the sudden movement, and she did the most natural thing in the world for a fox terrier. She launched herself at the threat. Wilna hit Bryn in the side of the face and hung from a jaw for a split second before the big dog simply shook her head and turned the terrier into a flying snarl of spit and teeth. She hit Cindy about midsection. Cindy slapped at her with her free hand, which Wilma latched onto, and when Cindy jerked her hand back up, the dog went with it. That's how Wilma ended up hanging from the elegantly dressed artist's left breast. I hit Cindy right behind Wilma, and we all slid along the sink and hit the floor in a tangle. Even as I was stripping the gun from her hand, I knew that I would be forever grateful that Cindy Altman didn't start pulling the trigger in the melee. She was strong, but I had the bulk, and soon jammed her face into the toe space under the cabinet while I applied my handcuffs that were still in my back pocket. I swung around, gun in hand, to look for Lily, but found that Vera had already taken control of that situation. In the time it took me to basically fall forward and smother a thin woman to the ground, Vera had headbutted Lily, breaking her pretty little nose. Then Vera simply stood up to clear her arms of the chair and fell into a backward somersault that ended with her hands in front of her. She had said that yoga classes would come in handy someday. By the time I looked up, she was sitting astride Lily, using the chain of the handcuffs to pin Lily's neck to the floor. Of course, the room was still full of bounding, barking dogs looking for the morsel of food that I'd dropped, and I still had to dig out my keys and take the handcuffs off my wife. But the battle of Terrier Tit was over. We pulled both women up and put them in the folding chairs, side by side. They were pouty and silent. I discovered that the gun had its safety on during the whole ordeal. Again, gratefulness washed over me. I became a little worried that Vera was in shock when she allowed me to check Cindy for dog bite and to corral Lily's errant breasts and button up her blouse. Vera was busy congratulating the excited, heroic dogs, while I was engaged in this very necessary process. Interestingly, although Wilna had bitten Cindy, her linen shirt had protected her, leaving only a small bruise. But Lily's left breast was sporting a fresh bite mark, and it didn't look canine in nature either. I glanced over at Vera and caught a glimpse of a self-satisfied smile. Once we had things pretty well sorted out, I called Butch to come and haul off the miscreants. When I flipped my cell phone closed, Cindy gave it one last stab.
Johnny, you can still let us go. I promise that I'll make it up to you.
I laughed.
Johnny, we're not guilty. We haven't done anything. If you let us go, I promise you can pay off your mortgage and get a real car instead of that old blue heap of yours tomorrow. I promise, Johnny.
Well, Cindy Lou, I might have taken you up on that deal except for one thing. I can't do business with anybody who insults my fan. I could see anger flash in her eyes again, and this time it stayed.
Come on, asshole! What's your price? Just name it! Damn it, we didn't do anything!
You know, that's the second time you've said that, Cindy. You didn't do anything. I don't know if you're directly responsible for the murders of three people this week or not, but I sure as hell know that you hired me under false pretenses, bugged my home, forced your way into my home, held me and my wife at gunpoint, and you let your little sidekick fondle my wife. I don't call that not doing anything, lady. I walked away with her begging for another chance, tears now streaming down her face. Lily sat quietly beside her, looking cross-eyed at her broken nose. When I met Butch and Eaton at the door, I noticed that it had grown dark outside. I said, "Damn, it's dark. Are we about to have a storm?"
"It's 7 o'clock, Speed. That's when it gets dark these days."
I felt the whole world wrench around. "You mean it's 7 o'clock at night? What day is it?"
"Don't worry. I've got a spare straitjacket in the car. I'm sure they'll take good care of you in the psych ward."
Butch answered the question.
"It's Friday, Speedy. I just left here a couple hours ago. Did you hit your head?"
"Well, if I did, I don't think I'd be competent enough to report it to you. But I'm okay. I just took a nap that seemed about 20 hours long and woke up with the two wicked witches of the south in the house. I really thought I'd slept through the night. Damn, I can't believe it's still Friday. This day just won't end." I excused myself and stumbled off to the bathroom. One hot shower and a change of fresh clothes later, I emerged to find the girls gone, the dogs back in obstacle course mode scattered around the floor, and the B&E team sitting at my kitchen table. The coffee machine was entering that frantic gurgling stage that signals the end of the brew. I suddenly thought of my Shearwater mug. The last time I saw it, Cindy was holding it as she leaned against the sink. Vera's voice came from behind me.
"Don't worry, your cup's all right. She put it down in the sink. Just go sit down, I'll take care of the coffee."
When she brought the tray with cups and carafe to the table, she said,
"Butch, you would have been proud of Johnny. Lily was on top of me, fondling me and rubbing her boobs all over me, and Cindy was threatening to kill the dogs and Johnny to boot, and all he was worried about was his precious coffee cups."
"Well, Vera, a man's got to have his priorities straight. For instance, I'm a heap more interested in hearing about this Lily situation in much greater detail than about the coffee cup problem. Eaton, if you've got to stare, at least close your mouth."
Eaton caught his breath while the rest of us laughed.
"And no, Johnny, neither of your favorite cups are here. You are not drinking out of those things till they've been through the dishwasher at least one time. You'll have to content yourself with the Carol Beale Birch's cup."
While I stirred various powders into my cup, it was Eaton's turn to laugh.
"Speed, I don't think you really like coffee at all. I think you've just got a coffee cup fetish."
"You're close to being right, Eaton. I never could stand coffee until we got our apartment in New Orleans and met Don at Coffee Tea Ore. But I've always loved good pottery, and coffee cups are relatively inexpensive and generally carefully made, especially if the potter is a coffee drinker."
"Well, we've got to get statements from you just about what happened tonight. Vera, why don't you and I go into the living room and these guys can stay here? We'll meet back up in about 30 minutes, and then I'd like to go through this whole mess step by step. By the way, Bill said something about a box of files that Cindy and Lily brought here."
"Butch, I don't want you to take those files before..." Vera's voice drowned mine out.
"Butch, take the damn things. Johnny, your case is closed, you hear me?"
I shook my head, thinking of buried treasure lying waiting in those files. But I said, I know when not to fight the tide. They're in the box next to the iMac. You can grab them on your way out. I was surprised at Eaton's interview skills. He was patient and thorough, asking questions that actually helped me remember several details that were already fading in my memory. We used every bit of the 30 minutes to cover what had certainly taken less than 5 minutes in real time. After a brief dispersal for a phone-slash-bathroom break, have you noticed how quickly we replaced the cigarettes in our lips with cell phones in our ears? We reassembled and began the ponderous march through the whole Grantham case. It quickly became apparent that Vera and I were watching the investigators actually put together the case that they would present to the prosecutors tomorrow. Butch had brought in 2 more file boxes of files to contribute. It was also apparent that Narlene, Goat, and Sonny would not be mentioned in this case. Everything was pared down to answer the questions of who killed Landis Grantham, how and why, and then the same 3 questions for Latimer Grantham and then Ray Ragonet. As we went along, we assembled pictures, notes, and reports into files to structure the presentation. We drank coffee, called out for pizza, drank tea, ate chocolate chip cookies, drank some more coffee. Finally, Eaton declared that we were finished. Butch and Vera went to dig out some celebratory beers from the fridge while Eaton and I carefully picked through the debris on the table, making sure we weren't about to throw out an invaluable document with the pizza box. Eaton glanced at his watch and announced,
Well, Speed, it looks like your Friday's finally over. It's almost 2 o'clock Saturday morning.
Eaton, for some reason that news is just not cheering me up. Butch and Vera returned with 7 redbacks. 7?
It's all we had. I told Butch you'd be happy to forego a second, being the gracious host.
Gracious hell? Those 2 harlots have gone too far if they've snuck in here and stolen my redbacks.
Don't worry, your beer stash is safe, Speedy. Eaton's driving tonight, and he never drinks more than 1 beer anyway.
Well, that was why I was asking. 1 beer for Officer Barton, 6 for me. Does that mean that y'all are going to drink... Oh, God. Give me my phone, quick.
I rose from my chair and motioned for everyone to follow me to the backyard and put a finger to my lips. Immediately, Vera knew what was going on and slapped a hand to her head.
I just remembered that I haven't checked in with Gojo. While I'm making this call, why don't you guys grab a beer and come check out the new deck Vera spent the summer working on?
As we came through the back door, I punched up Lurker. He answered immediately, as usual. Lurker either never slept or slept very lightly. Lurker, get your sniffer and get over here. I just learned that we definitely have a bug in the house.
On the way.
He cut the connection. I turned to Eaton. Sorry. There was 1 little thing I did forget to tell you. Cindy admitted that they had bugged the house. If there is another PI, or if the passenger in the Stratus is involved with these 2, everything we've said out loud tonight might already be in his hands. And by the way, I want to reiterate that I don't think Friday will ever end.
Oh, Speedy, stop your bitching. As I see it, you're the only one who has had even 1 nap today, much less 2.
I pondered that fact for a second.
You're right when you're right, Butch. Toss me a beer. I think I'm getting my 2nd win. Now, come to think of it, Saturday night's just getting started.
An hour later, we were all kicked back on Vera's deck, idly watching Lurker sniff the house through the windows. He was shadowed every step of the way by an entourage of puzzled dogs who had spent the last week trying to figure out just what he was up to on these frequent trips. He'd already found the bug, and was now looking for the receiver, apparently, by waving the bug around and creating some sort of feedback that he could hear with his earphones. I had to agree with the dogs. The spectacle was entertaining.
I don't want to dishearten you, but tonight's just the beginning. The prosecutors are going to want to talk to you next. Then there will be discovery hearings, grand jury testimony, and this one is going to be B.I.G. Before it's over, the CNN guys will be standing on top of MSNBC guys to peek into the courtroom, and the courthouse oaks will have more paparazzi hanging from their limbs than acorns.
Eaton, are you trying to tell me I ought to buy a new dress?
Butch drained the last of his 2nd beer and leaned forward.
Speedy, we've gone over this mountain of evidence. You've trailed these women for a week. You've stared at them over the barrel of a gun. What do you think? Did they do it? Are they guilty of premeditated murder?
Ask Vera. She knows them better than I do. We all turned to Vera.
They're guilty. The Granthams might well have paid for Marie to be killed, and Ragonet might have done the deed. I don't know if she killed Ragonet personally, but I can guarantee that Cindy Altman planned and orchestrated all three murders. And Lily Banks helped her, probably out of sheer boredom.
Yep, that's what I've been thinking too.
Well, you know, Big John always said that Southern murder trials center on two questions.
What, not three?
No, this time there were only two. He told me he heard it from a crack trial lawyer in Mobile. Anyway, Southern murder trials all center on two questions. One, did the son of a bitch need killing? And two, was the defendant the correct person to do the killing?
Bingo! That hits it right on the head. Folks, it's going to be mighty hard to convict these two pretty little women.
I looked up to see Lurker headed our way. He was holding a small solid-state recorder by its power cord. Beneath him, Wilna pranced, trying to catch the scent of this newfangled rodent, and maybe take a quick bite of it.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com. It's with quite some relief that we released this episode into the wild. We thought we had gotten past all our technical problems before Thanksgiving, when our main production system decided it needed a break. Well, we sent it to the shop and it came back whole and hale and working fine. I was even able to get through the bulk of the rest of the voice editing without so much as a burp. It was only when I started on final edits for this episode, and to put all its parts together ready for publication, that the system threw up its metaphorical hands and gave up. Evidently, replacing the power supply was not the right treatment last time, and we will be taking it back to the shop again this week. Fortunately, there is only one more episode in the story, although we are planning a wrap-up episode at the end. We'd like to share a few of the outtakes. Some are just outright hilarious. Talk to the author and some of the cast, and in general, say a final thank you to everyone who helped give voice to the novel. But before I wax all nostalgic, we have a few guest voices for this episode to thank. The trio of cops and college kids, who not only reminded us just where the famous Blue Stratus was found, but also of the dangers of wearing a dress while covered in ketchup in a Mississippi swamp, were Jim Van Verth of TheVintageGamer.net as Dude, the criminal justice student, that's TheVintageGamer.net, and appearing as Rabbit, we had P.G. Holyfield, author and podcaster of the fantasy novel Murder at Avedon Hill. And you can find out more about P.G. at pgholyfield.com. That's Holyfield with a Y in the middle of it. And with an all-too-brief appearance as Pete the Cop pulling Butch Ellis's leg, T. Morris, author and podcaster of Moravi, Legacy of Moravi, and Billabo Baddings and the Case of the Singing Sword, as well as co-author of Podcasting for Dummies and Expert Podcasting Practices for Dummies. And you can find all things T. Morris at TEEMORRIS.com. But our star guest voice, portraying Cindy Sparks Altman, artist, voyeur, puppet master, and criminal mastermind, was none other than Christiana Ellis. Christiana is the author and podcaster of Nina Kimberly the Merciless, a truly fine send-up of the barbarian fantasy genre. Christiana is also one of the geniuses behind the podcasts Talking About Stuff, Hey, Want to Watch a Movie, and Sci-Fi Smackdown. Keep an eye out for Space Casey, though, which is Christiana's latest project. We'll have all the links at the Dancing Cat Studios site. So we're almost done. Stick with us for just a couple more episodes. There are still a few surprises to be had.
Back in the midst of time, before D20, before Doom, before Settlers of Catan, there were other games. Role-playing games like Top Secret and Traveler, video games like Dark Castle and Mule, and board games like Titan, Cosmic Encounter, and Diplomacy. At the Vintage Gamer podcast, we remember those times. In fact, we seek out great games from an earlier era. Each episode, we go back and take a fresh look at an older game that has stood the test of time, to see what works, see what doesn't, and spend a little time reminiscing. So grab your bottle of 30-year-old scotch or a piece of fine Stilton and join us at The Vintage Gamer, available at www.thevintagegamer.net.
The Land of Cairn. It is a world where gods can choose to live mortal lives, to directly affect events in the world, and often do. The river of magic is rising. Monsters are moving into Cairn through tears in the fabric. The dead are escaping Callan's abyss. And the children of Aj have returned, just as the prophets foretold. But even as these overarching events play themselves out, a piece of the puzzle falls into place in the seemingly unremarkable town of Avedon Hill. Aramis Cragen, retired Aranic advisor, arrives at Avedon Hill and is asked to investigate the murder of Greta Platt, the Avedon Manor housemistress. But in doing so, Aramis uncovers secrets that threaten Cairn's very foundation. What begins as a search for justice becomes a fight for survival, all in a place where nothing is what it seems. Welcome to the Land of Cairn. Welcome to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel by P.G. Holyfield, featuring some of the great voices of podcasting and podcast fiction.
A perfect place for Greta Platt to escape the troubles of the day. So beautiful, so inspiring. Also a fine place for someone to catch her defenseless and end her life.
Not now, Joris. You chose the wrong time for one of your rants about undead threats rising
in Cairn.
There's
evil here in Avedon Hill. You can never be sure what will greet you at your door.
Of course it has to be alive. You should have known that, monk.
You promised us the hunter, and you have failed us. You promised us a power beyond our understanding, and again, you have failed us.
You have not seen what I have seen. Events are transpiring that neither you nor I can affect.
Aaron's powers have peaked from under those covers. I hope you both survive long enough to find a use.
Brother of Aaron, look how you've aged. You've spent so much of your life in darkness.
Murder at Avedon Hill by P.G. Holyfield. Sit back and let the mystery unfold. Learn more at pgholyfield.com and patiobooks.com.
200 years into the future, mankind has conquered the solar system. Humanity has entered a new era of peace and exploration. But a looming threat could spell the end of everything. The fate of civilization rests in the hands of an unlikely hero.
Excuse me, hero? You know, I've been called a lot of things over the years. Criminal, con artist, traitorous bitch. But hero? Well, yes, but they were being sarcastic. This is the story of how I saved the universe.
Space Casey is an audio drama miniseries from Christiana Ellis. Subscribe now at www.spacecasey.com.
You'll love it. Trust me.